The storm arrived without warning on a Wednesday afternoon, which was, Cecily Ashworth decided, precisely the sort of thing that happened when one was foolish enough to travel alone in November. She had been foolish enough. The carriage had cracked an axle on a road that had no business being called a road, more a suggestion of one, half buried under the first serious snowfall of the season. And the coachman, a sensible man named Burroughs, had assessed the situation with the calm practicality of someone who had seen worse, and immediately set about unhitching the horses. There was an estate, he told her, half a mile north. He had seen the gates on the way down. Whose estate? She had asked. Burroughs had not known, had not seemed to think it mattered. Cecily had looked at the snow, which was falling with increasing conviction, and had decided that Burroughs was correct. She walked the half mile with her traveling bag over one arm and her dignity largely intact, which was more than could be said for her boots by the time the iron gates appeared through the white. They were grand gates, the sort that announced consequence. And behind them, a long gravel drive disappeared into the gray. At the end of it, barely visible through the falling snow, stood a house that was not a house so much as a declaration. Stone. Old. Enormous. Every window dark except one on the ground floor, where firelight pressed warmly against the glass, like a hand against a cold cheek. She rang the bell. She waited. She rang it again. The door opened, and the man who opened it was not a butler. He was tall, unreasonably so, with dark hair pushed back as though he had recently run his hand through it and not particularly cared about the result. He wore no cravat. His shirt was open at the throat. He held a book in one hand with a finger pressed between the pages, marking his place, and he looked at her with the expression of a man who had arranged his life specifically to avoid this kind of interruption. His eyes were gray. Not the flat gray of an overcast sky, but the darker gray of deep water, and they moved over her with quick, assessing intelligence, before settling on her face. The road, she said, because she was cold and wet and she had walked half a mile, and she was not going to apologize for existing on his doorstep. My carriage lost an axle. My coachman has gone for the horses. I need shelter until the storm passes. He looked past her at the snow, which was now falling with something approaching ferocity. That may be some time, he said. His voice was low, unhurried, the voice of a man accustomed to speaking and being listened to. Yes, she agreed. I am aware. A silence stretched between them. Snow settled on her shoulders. She did not shiver, though she wanted to. Something shifted in his expression. Not warmth, precisely, but the absence of the refusal she had expected. He stepped back from the door. Come in, then, he said. She came in. The entrance hall was vast and cold and beautiful, all pale stone and high ceilings, and the kind of architectural confidence that only centuries of wealth could produce. There were no flowers, no personal effects on the side tables. The space had the quality of a room that was used for passing through rather than inhabiting. Functional grandeur, if such a thing existed. There is a fire in the study, the man said, already walking. The rest of the house is not heated. She followed him through two corridors and a door that opened into a room that was, by contrast, almost aggressively inhabited. Books covered every surface, stacked on shelves, piled on the floor, open face down on the desk, with the casual disregard of a man who lived alone, and answered to no one. A fire burned in the grate, large and generous, and two leather chairs faced it at an angle, one of them bearing the indentation of recent occupation, and a second book left open on the arm. He had been reading. Both books, possibly simultaneously. Sit, he said, gesturing toward the unoccupied chair. He moved to a side table and poured something amber into a glass and held it out to her. "You're cold." "I am," she said, taking it. "Thank you." She sat. The heat from the fire reached her immediately, pressing against her frozen face and hands like something almost painful in its relief. She wrapped both hands around the glass and breathed. He sat in the other chair, picked up his book, opened it. She watched him for a moment. This man who had let her in without asking her name, and who was now reading as though she were a piece of furniture that had arranged itself conveniently near his fire. "I am Cecily Ashworth," she said. He looked up. "James Cavendish." She waited for more. There was no more. He returned to his book. She drank her brandy and looked at the fire and thought that this was, without question, the strangest situation she had ever been in, and that she was not entirely sure whether she felt safer or less safe than she had standing in the snow. Burroughs did not return that evening. The storm made that clear by nightfall, pressing against the windows with a sound like something trying to get in. James, she had decided privately, that she would think of him as James, because Mr. Cavendish felt absurd given that she was sitting 3 feet from him in his study, while the world outside turned white, sent a servant to prepare a guest room, and informed her, without particular ceremony, that dinner would be in an hour. Dinner was served at a table built for 20, with 2 place settings arranged at one end, with the slightly improvised quality of a household unused to guests. The cook, she gathered from the apologetic manner of the footman, had prepared something simple. It was, in fact, excellent. James ate with the focused efficiency of a man who treated meals as logistical rather than social events. He refilled her wine without being asked. He did not make conversation. She made it for him. "How long have you lived here?" she asked. 3 years. "Alone?" A pause. "There are servants." "That is not what I asked." He looked at her across the table. Something flickered in his expression. Not irritation, she thought, but surprise, as though he was not accustomed to being pressed. "Yes," he said, "alone." "By choice?" "Miss Ashworth." His voice was even. "You are a stranger in my house during a snowstorm. You are welcome to my fire and my table. You are not, I think, entitled to my autobiography." She felt her chin lift. "You are correct," she said pleasantly. "My apologies. Tell me about the books instead." Another pause. Then, unexpectedly, the corner of his mouth moved. It was not quite a smile. It was the ghost of one. The structural suggestion of a smile, as though his face remembered the shape, but had fallen out of practice. "Which books?" he said. "The 2 you were reading simultaneously when I arrived." This time, the almost smile became something more definite. "One is a history of Roman aqueducts," he said. "The other is a novel about a woman who fakes her own death to escape a bad marriage." "And which do you find more compelling?" "The aqueducts," he said, without hesitation. "The engineering is remarkable. The novel is predictable." "Does she escape?" Cecily asked. "The woman? I haven't finished it." "I have read it," she said. "She does. And she builds something better." He looked at her. His gray eyes were intent in the candlelight, and she felt the weight of his attention as a physical thing. The experience of being actually looked at, not glanced at, not assessed for social utility, but genuinely observed. "Good," he said quietly. That was all. But the word landed with more warmth than she had expected from him, and she found herself looking down at her wine to avoid whatever expression was trying to form on her face. The storm did not pass the next day. It deepened. Cecily woke to a world made entirely of white, the windows opaque with it, the grounds below invisible, the drive she had walked up the previous afternoon completely erased. She stood at the window in her borrowed dressing gown and looked at the blankness and felt something that was not quite despair and not quite relief, and was possibly both simultaneously. She found James in the study again. He had clearly been there since early morning. There was a tray with the remains of breakfast on the desk, and three new books in the pile that had not been there the night before. He looked up when she entered. "The road will be impassable for at least 2 days," he said. "Possibly three." "Ah," she said. "There is a library, Sao Samao," he said, as though this were the relevant piece of information. "Second floor, east wing. You are welcome to it." She spent the morning in the library, which was extraordinary. Floor to ceiling, 2 stories of shelving, a rolling ladder, and the accumulated reading of what appeared to be several generations of Cavendishes, with eclectic and occasionally bewildering taste. She found herself pulling books at random and reading first pages and putting them back, which was not a thing she normally did. She was normally a methodical reader. Something about the strangeness of the situation made her restless. At noon, James appeared in the library doorway. "Lunch?" he said. It was not an invitation so much as a statement of fact, and she found herself following him back to the dining room without having decided to. The second day passed in a rhythm that surprised her with its ease. Books and fire in the morning. Meals at the oversized table. A walk attempted in the afternoon. They made it as far as the front steps before the wind made further progress inadvisable, during which she discovered that he knew the names of all the trees lining the drive and had opinions about the specific failure of the drainage on the east lawn. He spoke about the estate with the focused attention of someone who had spent 3 years learning it in lieu of learning anything about people, and she listened and asked questions and watched the way his face changed when he talked about something he cared about. The careful neutrality dissolving into something more alive, more present. "You love it," she said, as they retreated back inside, shaking snow from their coats in the entrance hall. He paused. "The estate?" "Yes." He considered this with the seriousness he seemed to bring to most things. "I find it honest," he said finally. "It asks nothing of me that I cannot give it." She looked at him. He was not looking at her. He was unwinding his scarf, his attention apparently on the task, but she had the sense that the sentence had cost him something, that it was more than he had intended to say. She did not press. She had learned, over the course of 1 day, that pressing James Cavendish directly produced retreat, while simply being present and receptive produced, occasionally, startling honesty. "I understand that," she said instead, quietly, and left it there. That evening after dinner, they returned to the study, and she picked up the novel about the woman who faked her own death, and he picked up the aqueducts, and they sat in companionable silence for an hour that felt, to Cecily, like the most natural thing that had happened to her in years. She had not known that silence could be comfortable. The silences in her life had generally been the kind that were full of things no one was permitted to say. "Why were you traveling alone?" he asked, without looking up from his book. She considered the question. "My aunt is ill in Edinburgh. I was going to her. In November. Without a companion." "I had a companion. She developed a cold and her mother forbade the journey." She paused. "I went anyway." He looked up then. "Why?" "Because my aunt asked for me specifically, and because she has always been the person in my family who..." She stopped, started again. "She has always seen me clearly. I did not want her to be ill and alone and wondering if I was coming." The fire popped softly. James was watching her with that intent gray gaze, and she felt the familiar impulse to qualify what she had said, to soften it, to make it smaller and less revealing. She resisted it. "That is loyal," he said. "It is just honest," she said. "She matters to me, so I came." A silence. Then, "What happened? Before the companion?" She blinked. "I beg your pardon?" "You said she has always seen you clearly. The phrasing implies others have not." He was, she realized, more perceptive than his silences suggested. She looked at the fire. "My family is..." She chose her words carefully. "My family has always been more interested in what I might become than in what I am. A good match, a useful connection, an asset managed correctly." She said it without bitterness, which was the result of having processed it thoroughly over many years. "My aunt simply, she simply asks me what I think about things and listens to the answer." "And that is remarkable to you." "Yes," she said simply, "it is." He was quiet for a long moment. The fire settled. Outside, the storm pressed on. "My father," he said, and then stopped. He set the book down on the chair arm. "My father wanted a particular kind of son. I was not it. I was too quiet," he said. "Too interested in the wrong things. Too unwilling to perform the version of myself that was required." He said it with the flatness of someone reporting facts rather than grievances. "When he died, I came here. I have been here since." She looked at him. He was looking at the fire, his profile sharp in the orange light, and she could see the cost of what he had just said in the particular stillness of his jaw. 3 years, she said softly. 3 years. "And you have been," she searched for the right word, "sufficient? Here alone?" He turned to look at her. Something in his expression had shifted. The careful neutrality was gone, replaced by something that was not quite vulnerability, but was adjacent to it, the way that dusk is adjacent to dark. "I had thought so," he said, "until recently." The sentence hung between them. She did not ask him to clarify. She understood what he meant, and the understanding settled in her chest like warmth from the fire, quiet and pervasive and slightly alarming in how quickly it had reached her. She looked back at her book. He looked back at his. Neither of them read a single word for the next quarter of an hour. The third day dawned clear and brilliant, which should have been a relief, and was not, precisely. Cecily stood at the window of her guest room and watched the sun come up over the snow-covered grounds and felt the clarity of the sky as something almost accusatory. The storm had ended. The road would be passable by afternoon, Burroughs had sent word. He had sheltered at a farm 2 miles south, and the horses were well. He would come for her. She dressed carefully and went down to breakfast and found James already at the table. And the morning had a different quality to it, a slight constraint, a self-consciousness that had not been present the day before. They were both aware, she thought, that the enforced arrangement was ending, and neither of them quite knew what to do with that awareness. "The road will clear by midday," she said. "Yes," he said. She buttered her toast. He drank his coffee. Outside the windows, the grounds blazed white and gold in the morning sun. "I owe you a considerable debt," she said. "You owe me nothing," he said immediately, and the quickness of it surprised her. "You were in difficulty. I had a fire and a spare room. The arithmetic is simple." "The arithmetic," she said, "does not account for 3 days of your books and your table and your..." She paused. "Your company." He looked at her across the table. His gray eyes were doing the thing she had catalogued over 3 days, the shift from neutral to intent, that quality of genuine attention that she had stopped bracing against somewhere around the second afternoon. "I found," he said carefully, "that the company was not a hardship." She felt something move in her chest, She set down her toast. James. It was the first time she had used his given name aloud. She watched him register it, the slight stillness, the way his hand paused around his coffee cup. I have been thinking, she said, about what you said last night, about being sufficient here alone, and I want to. I think I should tell you that I have spent the last 3 days being more myself than I have been in a very long time, and I am not sure what to do with that information except to give it to you honestly, because you have been honest with me, and it seems only fair. The silence that followed was the longest she had sat through in 3 days, and she had sat through considerable silence. Cecily, he said. His voice was rougher than usual. You are leaving this afternoon. I am, she agreed. My aunt is waiting. Edinburgh is 4 days from here. Yes. And you have a life there. Obligations. I do, she said. I also have... She met his eyes steadily. I also have a return journey. Something happened in his face. The careful, neutral, 3 years of solitude composure cracked open, and what was underneath it was so unguarded, so startlingly young and wanting, that she felt her breath catch. The return journey, he said slowly, passes this road. It does, she said, assuming the road remains navigable. November in the north, he said. The weather is unreliable. Extremely, she agreed. One might, he said, and she could hear him choosing each word with the precision of a man who had forgotten how to do this and was relearning it in real time. One might reasonably plan for contingencies. One might write ahead, she suggested, to ensure that a fire was lit. In the study, he said, where there are 2 chairs. Both of them near the fire, she said, by the third night. He looked at her. She looked at him. The winter sun poured through the windows and turned the snow outside to something brilliant and temporary, and she thought that this was what it felt like. This specific, terrifying, quietly joyful feeling to be seen by someone who had chosen to look. I would like that, he said. His voice was very quiet. Very much. She smiled. It was a real smile, the kind that started in her chest and worked its way outward without her permission, and she watched it do something to his face in return, watched the ghost of his almost smile become actual and complete and rather devastating. Then I will write ahead, she said, when I know my return date. I will ensure the fire is lit, he said. Burroughs arrived at 2:30. The carriage repaired, the horses rested, his manner professionally incurious about the circumstances of the last 3 days. James walked her to the door himself, which she suspected was not his habit. He handed her into the carriage with the formal correctness of a man who had been raised to know the gestures, and then, when the footman had stepped away, he held her hand for a moment longer than was strictly necessary. Travel safely, Sendra, Tamosia, he said. Tend your drainage problem, she said. The ghost smile appeared again, immediate and unguarded. I will. She settled back against the carriage seat as it pulled away down the long drive, and she did not look back, because she had decided she would not be the kind of person who looked back wistfully at things she was returning to. She watched the road ahead instead, and thought about Edinburgh and her aunt and the particular quality of firelight in a room full of books and the way a man's face looked when it forgot to be careful. She wrote the letter from Edinburgh on the 6th day of her visit when her aunt was sleeping and the afternoon was quiet. She wrote it in the straightforward way she did most things. No excessive preamble, no elaborate social performance. She told him her aunt was improving. She told him she expected to depart in 10 days. She told him the road north of his gates had been the most consequential road she had ever traveled, which she acknowledged was a peculiar thing to say and meant it anyway. His reply arrived in 4 days. It was brief. His handwriting was precise and slightly angular. The handwriting of someone who had strong opinions about clarity. He wrote that the East Lawn drainage had been addressed. He wrote that he had finished the novel about the woman who faked her own death, and that he had found the ending, upon reflection, correct and satisfying. He wrote that the fire in the study was lit every evening regardless. He wrote, at the very end, in a sentence that stood alone at the bottom of the page, "The chairs have not moved." She read that last line 3 times, and then folded the letter and put it in the inside pocket of her traveling case, where it remained for the 10 days until her departure. She arrived on a Tuesday afternoon, 3 weeks after she had left. The sky was a pale, cold blue, and the road was clear, and when the gates appeared through the bare trees, she felt something in her chest that was not quite nervousness and not quite joy, and was in fact both of them braided together so tightly she could not have separated them. The door opened before she reached it. He was wearing a cravat this time, she noticed. His hair was still pushed back in the same manner, and he still held himself with the particular stillness of someone who had learned to take up less space than his frame suggested. But his eyes, when they found her face, were warm in a way that 3 weeks ago would have seemed impossible for eyes that gray. "You came," he said. "I said I would," she said. "Yes," he said, "you did." He stepped back from the door and she stepped through it, and the house was warm this time. Fires lit in the entrance hall, the smell of wood smoke and something cooking, and it felt in a way she did not examine too closely, like arriving somewhere. The study was exactly as she had left it, books in the same productive chaos, fire burning with the same generous extravagance, 2 leather chairs facing the grate, neither of them near the far wall. She stood in the doorway and looked at the chairs, and then looked at him. And the smile that broke across her face was the same one as before, the kind that started in her chest and didn't ask permission. "You move them," she said. "I told you," he said from directly behind her, close enough that she could hear the warmth in his voice. "The chairs have not moved." She turned to face him. He was very close. His gray eyes were intent on her face with the focused quality she had spent 3 weeks thinking about, and she understood, looking at him now, that this was what it looked like when someone chose to stop being careful. "James," she said. "Cecily," he said. And then, because they were both people who had learned to say what they meant when they meant it, he cupped her face in his hands with a gentleness that was entirely at odds with the urgency in his expression, and she stepped forward into the space between them that had been waiting since the first evening, and the fire burned in the grate, and the winter light came through the windows, and neither of them sat in the far chair again. They married in the spring, in the small church at the edge of the estate, with her aunt in the front pew, looking extremely pleased with herself and Burroughs in the back, looking professionally incurious about the entire affair. The vows they exchanged were the formal ones, because James felt strongly about the architecture of tradition. But afterward, walking back through the grounds in the pale April sunshine, with her hand in his, he said the other ones, the real ones, quietly, and without ceremony, the way he said most things that mattered. "You came back," he said. "I told you I would," she said. "You were a stranger in my house," he said. "And then you were," he paused, choosing, "the most present person in any room." I had forgotten what that felt like. Someone being actually present. She looked up at him. "You let me in," she said, "in a snowstorm. With no warning, because it was the right thing to do. That was the first thing I knew about you. that you did the right thing without requiring an audience for it. He was quiet for a moment. The grounds were coming back to life around them, the trees budding, the lawn recovering, the east drainage performing admirably. I had been here 3 years, he said, and I had convinced myself I was content. Were you? No, he said simply. I was just very still. There is a difference. She tightened her hand in his. There is, she agreed. 2 years later, she found him in the study on a November afternoon, the fire burning, the books in their permanent productive chaos. And he was reading to their daughter, who was 18 months old and profoundly uninterested in the aqueducts, but deeply interested in the sound of his voice, which was, Cecily had always thought, one of the more sensible positions available to anyone. She stood in the doorway and watched him, this man who had opened a door in a snowstorm and let the world back in, and felt the accumulated weight of 2 years of ordinary happiness. Fires and books and meals at a table built for 20 that had gradually begun to feel exactly the right size. As something so solid and warm that it was almost architectural. He looked up and found her in the doorway. Tell me again, he said, the way he sometimes did, how you found me. I walked half a mile in the snow, she said, moving into the room, settling into her chair, the near one, always the near one, and rang your bell twice, and you answered it looking like a man who had arranged his entire life to avoid exactly that. And yet, he said, and yet, she agreed, you let me in. He reached across the small distance between the chairs and took her hand. Their daughter, apparently deciding that the aqueducts could wait, reached for his book with the confident authority of someone who had never been told she couldn't. Outside the windows, the first snow of the season was beginning to fall. Thank you for staying with Cecily and James until the very end. Their story began with a broken axle and a stranger at the door, and became something neither of them had thought to hope for. Proof that the right storm, arriving at the right moment, can open doors that careful living had long kept shut. If you want more stories about impossible circumstances and the people brave enough to walk through them, subscribe and ring the bell, and you will be the first to know when the next one arrives. You are the reason these stories exist, and I am grateful for every one of you.